Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for being here at the Bay Area Book Festival and this great session this afternoon, Our Trump, Our Television, Our Bad Luck. I'm assuming everybody's in the right place when I said that title. Nobody got up and left the room screaming. It is my pleasure to introduce our speaker this evening. My name is Kevin Smokler. I'm an author here in the Bay Area. And I was fortunate enough to be called upon to introduce our speaker. We sit alone in the dark. It's how a movie begins, and it's how many of us begin our love affair with arts and culture that we have our entire lives. No matter how smart we are, or how wise we are, at some point the lights dim, and there we sit, alone and in the dark. Now, the great choreographer Twyla Tharp actually said that this is the process that creation happens too. A dancer begins in an empty studio, an actor on an unlit proscenium, and a writer in front of a wordless page. Tharp suggests that you simply stamp your foot, yell begin, and go. She has not quite acknowledged that there is something particular about sitting alone in the dark. Our guest today, a hero and inspiration of mine and so many others, makes another what I believe is a more humane suggestion. That first we acknowledge how strange and vulnerable and therefore human this meeting is, of art and of citizen, of human and of human creation. And out of respect for it and for culture itself, we must bring our most rigorous selves to this mysterious meeting. To learn by being moved instead of feeling superior by refusing to feel. In what seems to be our least powerful state there, alone and in the dark, we are called upon to be even more than we can imagine. The meeting of ourselves and the things we create, in fact, demands it of us. From this struggle, in the dark, to understand, we ultimately build and tend to a great fire of something called wisdom. It's hot, it's a little dangerous, but it is as bright and as true as a star. For many of us who have devoted our lives to writing about arts and culture, the work of David Thompson is that star, a kind of true north we have used to first grope and then navigate our way out of the dark. He has shown, then reminded us, that to write about a movie is to write about the movies, all 120 years of them, and that the assignment is large, but you must always begin here, in the moment, down here on Earth, right now. Your rigor, your intelligence, your wisdom, and yes, your joy for the subject is the gift you share with those gracious enough to read you. And that exchange, while grand in purpose, gets there first by being as intimate and as real as a handshake and as unbroken as a look in the eye. I do not have to tell any of you here that the importance of clear, hard-fought, wise communication in this era of fake news and might makes right modes of political discourse. But I'll go even further than that. If we cannot speak and write and communicate about art with the same fire that we bring to politics and current events, we are burning down a fundamental part of who we are. As Joan Didion said, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. So why not bring our best selves to the things we make, and therefore to the way we live? David Thompson has been one of my great teachers in this respect. He sits in a very small constellation in my corner of the sky with Joan Didion and with Albert Murray and with James Baldwin. My own three books probably seem like a shed next to the skyscraper of his nearly 40. I take that to mean I will have his example to study and learn from a very long time. It was the great English poet John Masefield who said, "I must go down to the seas again, to the lonely sea and the sky. And all I ask is a tall ship and a star to steer by." The seas and the sky of our contemporary moment seem vast and roiling and violent and lonely. They will feel less so if we steer by the bright wisdom of our stars, those that call upon us in the dark to be thoughtful instead of thoughtless, and to contend with rather than to merely confront. David Thompson has been called the greatest living film critic and historian. The author of over 36 books, his work appears regularly in the New York Times and in The Guardian and The New Republic and Salon. The winner of the San Francisco International Film Festival's Mel Nivikoff Award for contributions to the cinematic community of the Bay Area, Mr. Thompson hails from London and now calls San Francisco home. Please welcome the Polaris for myself and for so many of us, David Thompson.
I've never had an introduction like that. I would be tempted to say it was huge, but I'm going to be very careful with that kind of language today. I'm not going to talk about the movies either, so I hope you won't be disappointed, and if you think I am, perhaps you should leave now. And I need to look at you first. I know some of you. I'm married to one of you. You're not feeling well, are you? No. I know. I have it too. It's a mixture of depression and anger, dread and desire. You think you may be having a breakdown. Shrinks say we are. Or is it the whole world coming apart? You ask yourself whether your head is filled with a nightmare, a dream, or are you awake? And is it actually happening? How can a real, solid, provable country, once rooted in fact, science, money, and property, be living out an insane horror story? When will we be saved? You stay up night after night, and you cannot decide whether Rachel Maddow is a kind of Joan of Arc, or a dark, once Russian, once Castro Valley, once Stanford, once Jewish, Lucy Ricardo. How can she recount these stories of betrayal and intrigue with such mounting glee? Why is she so close to helpless laughter? Is she going crazy? Will this torment end, or does it go on forever? Now, before I say this last thing, I have to say that I've been looking lately at the film Rebecca, so it sort of leans upon a little bit of your knowledge. Could be a big laugh line, though. I'm hoping. I woke up and dreamed that I had gone back to Mar-a-Lago, but it was underwater. That terrible Rebecca had drowned along with all of us. We are in a movie, and there's no going back, no waking up. Now, I am here as a professional author to recommend to you this book, Television, a Biography. And I want to tell you a story about the writing of the book and the doing of the book, which at the time seemed to be a curiosity, but it's come true in an alarming way. I wrote this book finally in 2015 and 2016, and my editor read it and made many great suggestions, and we worked together on the book. And one of the things he commented on, and he picked up on this more than a year ago. Can you remember more than a year ago? The innocence in which we existed. And he said, "Now, you're making a lot about Donald Trump in this book." And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "I get it. I mean, you don't like him, do you?" I said, "No, I didn't like him." That was a year ago, though. I mean, you know, so much changes in a year. Why is he important? The editor said. And I said, well, I think, amidst his incredible ignorance, stupidity, vulgarity, tactlessness, the feeling of him having showered in slime, he has an incredible instinct for television. And more than a year ago, I said, I think that is going to figure quite a bit in the year ahead. And he said, well, yeah, I can see that. I don't think I really believe it, he said, but I can see the possibility, and it's very intriguing. But he said, you got to be careful, because this book is going to come out days before the election. And if you say anything too strong in the way of a prediction, let alone a characterization of him, you could end up looking very silly if events take a quite different turn. And I understood what he was saying, and I believed in it, and I weighed it and considered. And I phrased it as I thought, carefully and cannily, to get round what might happen. And I said what I believed, which is that Donald Trump is really, was, a genius of television. But he does not really want to win the election. Why did I say that? Because he knew that being president is no fun. And he loves fun. If he's going mad now, and there's some reason to think he is, it's the lack of fun, it's the absence of fun, the restrictions on him for groping women, among other things, that is really oppressing him. And this is a very oppressed man, and in my calculation, never more dangerous than when oppressed. So I said, he doesn't want to win the election. He's very happy for her to win it. He'd be happy for anyone else to win it. This is what he wants, and I say this in the book. He wants to launch on Inauguration Day a television show in which he will simply speak, and he will tear her to pieces in advance of anything she may do, but when she does something, and he will tear anyone and everyone else to pieces. He will occupy television in a way that he is comfortable with and happy with, and he will become an extraordinary living storm in the electronic system. And it may be that he will throw her presidency off balance, out of control. And in many ways, it's possible that by simply being the voice on another channel, he will be as destructive as he's capable of being. You know, I worked it out carefully. Publisher said, yes, I think that's good. I think that's good. I think that's probably pretty close. I can see and hear that show. I understand how he's going to do it. It might be fun to watch that show. It might have been fun to watch that show. It didn't turn out that way. And don't be under any illusion that he is furious about the mistake that occurred, about him being elected. And it only supports his essential emotional attitude to the world, which is that he is the victim. And victims dream of vengeance. And whatever else that man is doing in his sleepless nights, he's dreaming. And I believe, and I think the facts demonstrate it, that more or less he has contempt for the presidency, just as he has indifference to the country that he insists on being great again. But he won. And I'm not saying he didn't win. I don't know what happened in terms of the interference with the election. I don't really have any comments to make about the conduct of the election. I just feel that he walked into that office and that job as a victim, limping in his soul. And trouble lay ahead of a kind that is hard to imagine. And remember this about this whole phenomenon. We have constantly been surprised. My editor and I were surprised that he became so serious a candidate. Pretty well the nation, I think, was surprised on November the 8th when those results came in. Many people were devastated. Many people entered into the state of walking nervous breakdown that so many of you are suffering from. And I spoke to a shrink earlier this year, and she said she could not keep up with the number of people who wanted to come and see her. And she said, it's all very well, but where do I go? So, when I say he's a genius of television, I do not mean to use that term in any way that would enter into the levels of genius that we have come to accept as being possible in music, in painting, in writing, in film, in soccer, things like that. He has an instinct for television. And although I do not believe he could articulate this, because I don't really think he can articulate anything, I think that instinct has the sense that what television is doing is altering our relationship with reality and even our faith in reality. He does not want reality to exist because it is a dimension in which he could be found out and pulled down. And he loves the idea of being a face and a voice on television and in the social media, because again, he has surprised us. He didn't come on television all the time. He came on Twitter all the time. And in many respects like that, he is ahead of the curve. But he loves the unreality, because I suspect, and I think that the people who have tried to know him in his life would say, that he has been an abject failure at living at any level of reality. And watching someone who is crazy can drive you crazy. There may be people here who've lived with people who were deeply depressed, mentally disturbed, and you know that it's not just something that puts you in the position of caring for them and trying to treat them and comfort them, it's infectious. A warped sense of reality spreads. And I want to speculate over a few possibilities that might happen, knowing that almost certainly what's going to happen is something none of us could quite imagine. Because surprise, shock, is of his essence. But I see ways in which it could go. I can conceive that one day, quite soon, he might buy airtime on most of the networks and come on. He would wear casual clothes. Can you believe? He would dress as casually ever. He would come on in casual clothes. And he would say, look, people, I'm really bored with this. People aren't being fair to me. I can't do anything I want to do. I'm getting mocked. And all I have to do is try and talk to people like Bannon and Kellyanne. It's no life. I used to have fun. I'm not going to tell you the fun I had, because if I were to tell you the fun I had, you'd impeach me much more quickly than you might do anyway. But I just don't like it, and I'm going home. I'm going back to Mar-a-Lago, and fuck you. Because that's what I'm doing. And just forget me. Lose my life now. I might write my memoir next week, or I might get someone to write my memoir next week. But I've had enough. You haven't played fair. You haven't given the Donald a chance. And, you know, I've always had a little bit of a persecution complex, and I really have it now. And it makes me angry. And I know, getting angry, I could do damage. And I do. Well, I don't think I want to do damage. So I'm going home. That could happen. Would you really be surprised? Would cause a sensation. One of the great television evenings in our history, way beyond Lyndon Baines Johnson saying, I've decided not to run again. I'm going home. When you think about it, it is a superb commentary on America. Don't you all treasure that moment at the end of the awful days when you just go home? If you have a home. Many people in this country don't have a home. But that is something, it's a retreat. It's a security that means a great deal to us in this time. Now, I think he could almost literally explode. If you watch the man, he is expanding. I can't remember the last time he could do a jacket up. And the ties seem to be getting bigger to cover the expanse of stomach. I can't talk too much about this, but I'm going to talk about it. That is showing. And I do not believe he's physically well. But I'm not physically well, and I don't think many of you are. And he could say he's getting ill for the sake of the country and the world. He's making a sacrifice. I think he could explode. I think he could have a heart attack. He could have a stroke. He could have some total undermining of belief and instinct and everything. And he could just sit there staring at the television screens that he watches. And even if they're showing him, there would be no registration of impact. Have you looked at his face lately? His mouth? The mouth is growing longer and harder. Rigor is already setting in his mouth. No, look at him next time. It's there. When he was a young man, he looked quite fun. You know, I mean, Marla Maples said he was really quite fun, and I can believe he was. The fun is gone. And something is happening to him physically that is dreadful, and it has to do with what I take to be that essential mistake that occurred when he was elected. Because he was looking forward after the election to about 2 months off, then do the TV show. You know, you can see that life working out for him. It's his kind of life. It didn't happen. He's suffering for it. So that could happen. Now, he could be impeached. They'd have to explain to him what impeachment is. And I don't think he'd understand it, but it could happen. It could work. It's worked before. Most of the people in this room have got some memory of when it worked before. And what will happen then? Well, you know who's left. And you know that in effect, the effects and the consequences of that terrible election are not going to be put back in the bottle. He will be succeeded by much lesser versions of himself, unless some real version of himself, like Bannon, takes even more control and power than he has now. And I don't know how that would work out. Impeachment is a very long, slow, drawn-out process, and I fear that we're going to have to listen to Comey hedging his bets endlessly when he testifies. The testimony may be valuable, it may be damaging to Trump, but I think he's going to take so long over qualifying everything he says that we may not all be awake by the end of it. It could work out. And those are really the favorable versions of what might happen. There's another way of looking at it, and I think if you look at the man as a psychic dynamo, a flagging psychic dynamo, you can see the possibility of this. Again, he wouldn't understand it because he knows no history and does not read history and does not talk to the people who might share it with him, but he's a fascist. And fascists and totalitarian leaders wait for great crises, because great crises are the moments when they can change all the rules. And you can look at small crises. I'm just supposing you understand with this. You're not going to go out and repeat this, are you? Because I could be thrown out of the country for this, but he might say, someone has to be murdered. And it might as well be someone I'm sick and tired of. So it might be Bannon, because I think Bannon intimidates him. Or it might be Jared Kushner. Or it might be someone else we hardly know. But the murder could be arranged in such a way, and you all know that murders can be arranged. You know the line from The Godfather Part II where Michael says to Tom, Tom, we can kill anyone if we want to. And you remember, or if you don't remember, you were told about when, on the premises of a police station, a man walked up to the chief suspect in the greatest murder case of the year and shot the suspect dead. And you know how you were left wondering, well, what the hell does that mean? Is that just another chance madman? Or does that mean that there's a story, a plot going on? We still don't know the answer, but we live with the possibility that there is an intrigue and a plot. So murdering someone, it's not that difficult. And a murder, particularly a lurid, really melodramatic murder, could be taken to say, they, the terrorists, or the outlaws, or the enemy, or the New York Times, or us, we did it. We killed Bannon. Therefore, I'm bringing down some version of extra tight security, some kind of martial law. We've really got to batten down the hatches. We've got to put this country under control. I'm asking the Supreme Court to do what I'm asking them to do instead of shilly-shallying around. And I don't know what would happen. I think John Roberts could be an absolutely crucial person in what's going to happen in the next year or two. And I don't read him well enough to know how brave he is, or how brave the rest of them are. I know that some of the rest of them are not exactly brave. But I don't know what they would do. The Supreme Court clearly could stand up against some of the measures I'm imagining that he might take on. But of course, murdering Bannon or Jared Kushner, which could have other collateral benefits in that they couldn't testify, is a fairly minor crisis compared with what you might get in, say, Syria or North Korea. And a lot of people in this country believe stern, tough action, American action, should be taken in North Korea. So it's not as if there would be an outpouring of outrage and indignation, even if one of their wretched bombs sneaked through and dropped on some island in the Pacific and obliterated it. But that could be the circumstance of a crisis that changed everything and changed the status of the president, so that a president, even a president at his age, and a president who until recently had been terribly deprived of fun and was the victim of witch hunts and so much else, could say, well, the country needs me at this moment, so trust me, and what you have to do here and now is give me a third term. Outrageous? Impossible? Unbelievable? I would have thought so a year ago. I'm not sure now. He has blundered into a world of extraordinary vulnerability. I do not think he's afraid personally. I doubt he knows where his children are enough to be really concerned about the effects a crisis might have on them. I think he has a sort of insane courage that comes from understanding nothing about life and experience, language, reality. I think he's capable of doing absolutely appalling things. To which he would say, and he might say it, his last Twitter might be, look, the world was going to end anyway. And it sort of is. And he almost said this week, and there's a lot of truth in what he said, look, that whole Paris Agreement, which was not really an agreement, it was going to affect us by a tiny amount. When the Paris Agreement was made, the people who know the truth about that field and that area said, well, it's a start, so I'll clap with one hand, but it's tiny compared with what is needed. And many of those people say, it doesn't matter what you do, the water's coming up. Mar-a-Lago, that precious sanctuary, will go underwater, along with the Bay Area, New York, London, any place that you might hold precious. In other words, to the extent that this man believes anything, he believes the world is headed for destruction. In which case, perhaps he could be a protagonist in that movie. There are other possibilities, I'm sure, which I can't think of for the moment. And it's exhausting to think about them. And it's why we don't feel well. But we have to feel well again. We have to feel well again for our children. Can you imagine being 22 in this world, just graduated? Our son graduated a couple of weeks ago, and there's a desperate, forlorn look on his face. He's a handsome boy. He's got immense charm. But I don't know that he believes that there is a world out there into which he can fit. Now, I hope it will turn out differently. I hope it's going to work out for him. And I will do everything I can for that, and his mother will do everything we can for that. But people of that age are not overflowing with optimism, which is one reason Why, compared with their forebears from the 1960s and the early 1970s, they really have no political involvement whatsoever. I think that has to end. I'm not saying sign up with a party. I think Trump is in the process of destroying the political parties. But I think our action might still be very important. I think a moment may come for something that has never happened in this country, never really happened anywhere, an immense, near total general strike. Now, one of the troubles about it is that someone's going to need to organize it. And as soon as you have strike organizers, people like Trump can fix upon those people and put them in prison. And they can tell every story they can imagine about how corrupt those people are. And in America, historically, organizers have tended to be corrupt. Let's face it. But what happened in the election wasn't simply a wicked, personless person. It was a mass of Americans feeling such distress that they actually voted against their interests. A lot of them know it, and they're going to find it out, that the very people who voted in heavy numbers for him are first in line to suffer from anything he does if, big if, he ever gets to pass legislation. And those are our brothers. You sometimes come upon family members who've got other family members they hardly speak to anymore. You've got that feeling? Families are being split apart. In the way that you hear in history, families in the Civil War were split apart. That is happening in this country, and do we educate those people? Do we forgive them? Or do we learn from them? Why are they so distressed and depressed? And you know, they were depressed ahead of us. And they were depressed ahead of us for very good reasons, that they had hardly anything in life. You want to get out in the sunshine? I'd love to hear your questions in a minute. I have just one thing to say, finally. I have an aspect of my life that not too many of you here will have. That I was once a citizen of another country. And I chose to be American. I chose to be American because I loved many things about the country, because I loved the people in the country, and I felt that it offered freedoms that my country had not offered. But I have never understood why sane, reasonable, decent people in this country talk about the need to make this country great again. Countries do not have to be great. Some are bigger than others. Some are richer. Some are more powerful than others. Some are more stupid than others. That's life. You can work a lot of those things out if you've got time. But they don't have to be great. And it is to say that you are great and the greatest and are about to become great again is deeply offensive to Belgium, to Venezuela, to Pitcairn Islands, fairly insignificant places on this earth, in all of which wonderful things and terrible things are happening without the people in those countries feeling compelled to say, aren't the Pitcairn Islands great? God, I mean, the Leeward Islands, Antigua, they're in the shade. Pitcairn Islands have it. We've got it. We are the islands when it comes to that. You don't need to say that. You don't need to think that. And it seems like a casual and a small thing in the way of what you need to do. But it's a beginning. This country has great things. It has the Canyon de Chelly. It has the desert. It has two extraordinary oceans. It has a kind of diversity sometimes. When my son graduated last week, we were in a church in New York. I have never been personally present in a crowd as ethnically diverse as that crowd. And I am a person, as I told my son this week, who had my first conversation with a person of color when I was 17. That was in England. I had simply never met a black person to talk to. And there I was, 50 years later, let's say, 60 years later, I'm afraid, in this extraordinary crowd of people from all over. Now, I'm not saying that all those people were happy about their situation in being there, that they didn't feel exploited and deprived and still not of the mainstream, not great in the way that America is foisted upon them as a great organism, but they were there. And America has an unrivaled record at bringing people together into a there like that. But that doesn't mean it's great or has to be. It's doing its best. It's muddling through. No country that does not have a universal healthcare system can begin to consider the prospect that it might be great. It is seriously and deeply deprived. And that problem, that deprivation, is within reach of remedy. It's actually quite simple. People come together and they help each other out. I don't know whether we have the time or the will or the energy or the luck, and luck's involved, to remedy those things. I do believe we face an appalling crisis. And I think that in the next year, most of us are going to have to make huge decisions about what we might do in a crisis. And it's not going to be pretty. There's going to be violence. Because while this country does not have universal health care, it has almost universal weaponry. In other words, nearly everyone who's going to be angry at whatever happens has got access to a gun, and they have been living in the habit that believes they can use that gun. Murder is really not that far away. So, I'm going to stop. I'm tired. I'm not well myself, you know. But if there are any observations or questions or comments, you need to just put your hand up and wait for a microphone. Yes, there's a lady there, I see. Yeah.
I thought one of the most telling phrases last Thursday was Trump saying, other countries are laughing at us. And I'm wondering what your take is on that, his use of that phrase, which he said twice, I think.
Well, I think it's a wonderful observation, and I mean, I don't think humor is strong in that blood. I mistrust his sense of humor totally, and I think that he has a kind of paranoia, a bully's attitude to the world that is terrified of being laughed at. I think, therefore, that blatant satirical aggression is a very valuable tool to use against him. I think we have every right to do everything we can to unhinge him finally. And I think that I wish there had been more Alec Baldwin. Alec Baldwin seems to have got a case of caution, which I don't think is common in him, but he seems to have. But, you know, I mean, Saturday Night Live is not the only thing. But I think that he deserves to be laughed at. I tried to, this afternoon, to introduce some humor into what I said. And what I said is very dark, and I feel it deeply. But I think that's a very big part of something we can do. And I think it's a very American thing. I mean, you know, what the fuck is Covfefe? Someone else? All right. Oh, yes, yes. My friend. Yes.
Thank you. Given the personality that you sketch and the genius for television, part of which reinforces the whole fake news, if you're a Trump supporter, don't listen to anybody else. What kind of communications to Trump supporters do you think might get through, might unmask this, or at least give a different spin? Because sitting in a lecture hall in Berkeley is not going to do
it. No.
Publishing it in the New York Times is not going to do it.
I think
in the world isn't going to do it. So what kind of communication?
I think that this revelation could have a profound effect, and I think it's very possible that it will happen. As the investigations make their very slow way forward, and it's proper that they be slow and careful, let us suppose it is revealed that, in fact, the Russians really didn't do a great deal to affect the election, but it is brought out more fully that Trump's business enterprises owe them, and not only them, a fortune, and that a kind of tacit blackmail has been going on. Now, I think if that is revealed and made clear, I think a lot of his supporters, who are essentially people with no money to spare, are going to be very struck by it. The continued failure to present his taxes is monstrous. Even while he's planning tax plans, about a page long, that are so gross, so drastic in what they would do to the country as a whole. So I think that could happen. I think that because the Americans have filthy minds, I think a sexual scandal could come through. I think betrayal of his children, neglect of his children. I really wonder a lot, and I'm very cautious about this because this is an innocent person, but I wonder what is happening with his young son. I think something terrible might be coming there. I think Melania could crack. And I think that any of those very personal things, like he robbed us of $3 billion personally, or he's been raping virgins in the cellar of the White House, or somewhere, you know. I think those things could get through. I don't guarantee it, but they could. Yes, there's a question.
Yeah, you mentioned, and correctly, of course, that many of Trump's voters were very distressed and didn't see a way out. But I would say the majority were not those distressed people, but, you know, your typical Republicans, suburban housewives. And they did not change in terms of voting for Trump versus Romney or someone else's more mainstream.
Well,
and so maybe you can talk a little about that and what their motivations.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and I can't disprove it, but you used a word that I think we could put a moratorium on. Typical. I'm not sure that America is really a country of typical people. I think its virtue as an idea depends on it being a country of individuals. And I don't think the people that you're calling the typical Republicans would stand up and say, yeah, I'm a typical Republican. Some of them might. And there are perhaps typical Democrats. But I think it's very important that these people feel they are themselves. And I think they have a right for their case and for their voting decision to be made. You know, there was somebody active in the election who really addressed this issue and said that the only really typical thing about America at large is how many people are having a terrible time. Now, I'm happy to tell you, this is a personal thing, don't let this get outside the room, that four times in the last year, strangers on the street have thought I was Bernie Sanders. That's the man I'm thinking of. And the son who graduated 2 weeks ago told his mother a year ago, you should vote for Bernie Sanders. And we said, oh, Bernie Sanders doesn't have a chance. I think we were wrong. I think his virtues have come through very strong lately, and my admiration for him has increased. So I'm wary about the word typical. But I'm just a typical English liberal in America, you know. All right? Are we done? Yes. Down here. Lady in orange and blue. Here. Oh, it's coming.
Thank you, David. First of all, everything you said, especially with respect to, I can't even say the man's name, so I'll call him number 45.
Right.
Because my Irish blood starts boiling when I say his name. But the way that he has totally altered reality, I have a nearly 14-year-old son, and sometimes when I hear the teens speak, I just, my insides just curl, because I think, what has he made? This country has been at perpetual war mode since before he was in my womb. And I want to contend that this book that I just wrote, my first novel, I don't think there's such thing as a genre as a political twister. I made it up, so maybe I'm a trendsetter. But pretty much what I'm saying in here is everything you're saying is our politic itself is the twister. When you look at our headlines, anybody with their right mind who understands true American history, I mean, the American Spanish-American War was started by propaganda. It's all twisted. And what you say really resonates well with me as a mother of a nearly 14-year-old boy who I feel as though our generation, not just the millennials that you're mentioning, your son, for instance, the teens of today have been imposed upon with the likes of the insanity within our politic itself. And that's frightening.
Yeah. But you know, this is my last word. You have to go home after this. It's bad, but the young have resilience. And when our son graduated from college, he almost straight away said, returning to one of his passions, he said, Dad, we've got to play bridge again. Now, some people are giving up bridge because of a word that is used in the game. Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.